What I've been trying to do, and since this is a kind of a review session, I'll emphasize this again, is the idea I've been developing in this point of the class is that religions really aren't static. We think of religions as being static, but they're not. They change over time, and if we think about it, we know that that's true, but we don't tend to think about it. And of course, if we're fundamentalists in our attitude, then we're seeking for an authentic view of religion that underlies maybe the appearances of things. So here's what let me be clearer what I mean about this. There were a number of people who obviously look at the Bible, the New Testament, say it's like, this is the word of God. It's inerrant. It is correct. It is the truth of matters. And of course, if they think about it, they realize that, wait a minute, God didn't speak in English. I mean, okay, so there's a slight problem. We're reading the King James Version of the Bible, which is the most popular version of the Bible still, as far as I know. And what we've got here is a book that's presumably full of the sayings and the recorded, presumably, full of the recollections of the, say, the apostles and Paul and whatnot. That's all the stuff that's in the New Testament. But if we think about it, we know that they didn't speak English. Even if we don't know what language they spoke, we know that they didn't speak English. But, of course, people won't think about this. But if that's the case, then if they know anything about language, they know that this is a translation, and a translation cannot be 100% accurate, and that's going to create some issues in itself. So, but that requires using the gray matter. But if you continue to use the gray matter, then you begin to ask this question, well, is there stuff in this book that maybe doesn't belong there, that kind of get added later, or misinterpretations, or, you know, historical overlay, because, you know, the Acts of Paul are from the late part of the first century AD. That's almost 2,000 years ago. Maybe there's been a little confusion between now and then, or something's gotten lost, or there's some copying errors, any kind of possibility. Well, anyway, the idea then is that you might want to look for what's authentic. So, in fact, in the 20th century, a bunch of really top scholars in the United States and Europe, I think United States and Europe, certainly United States, but I think included some European scholars, they got together to do something that was called the Jesus Seminar. Professor Bork at Oregon State was involved in this, and I had a buddy when I was teaching at Wesleyan University in Connecticut who was involved in the Jesus Seminar. They're all really great scholars, spoke all the relevant languages, they read all the relevant languages of the time. It was like, what's in the Gospels that Jesus really said? In other words, what did the guy say? Let's get to what original Christianity is. They didn't end up with very much. They found a whole lot of stuff in there that they could tell, for all kinds of reasons, were later additions in the Gospels, let alone anything else. So they came up with a short list of things that they were relatively certain that Jesus said. And they considered that quite an accomplishment of scholarship, because they had to agree on things, they had to explore all this stuff, and so on and so forth. Well, okay, so I'm not going to go into the Jesus Seminar, what that was about. What they were trying to do, though, was they were recognizing that religions change over time. And so they wanted to take a look at what was the original form. So what we've been talking about is Buddhism. And there was a period of time when Western scholars recognized, and this is in the 20th century, they recognized that there were apparently different kinds of Buddhism all over the world. And so they thought, well, wait a minute, there's a lot of contradictory stuff going on here, apparently, from their point of view. And there's a lot of stuff that's tied to specific cultures. So they thought, well, what did the original Buddhism look like? What did the Buddha really say? Can we figure this out? Now, if you think about what was behind that, from a certain point of view of scholarship, you could say, well, that's kind of an interesting project. But it assumes that if Buddha didn't say it, it's not really Buddhism. Because it assumes that all later development of the religion is somehow not authoritative in the same way. maybe not authoritative at all, because it's later than the time of the Buddha. So if the Buddha didn't say it, it's not Buddhist. It's like if Jesus didn't say it, it's not really Christian. But that assumes that the Christian church doesn't have any part in Christianity being Christianity, that only if Jesus said it is it Christianity. But there wasn't even any Christianity in Jesus' time. Even Paul never referred to himself as a Christian. That's all later, you know. So where does this come from? So on the one hand, it comes from the idea that maybe things shouldn't change, or maybe things don't change, or maybe if things change, they're not authentic or it's not true in some way. And if you really think deeply, 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 deeply about this, one of the things you recognize is that this is based on the idea of, or the myth, the Edenic myth. So we're back to myth. See, a lot of what goes on in scholars' minds is not really based on objective scholarship. It's based on cultural valuation. So feminist scholars, for example, came along and said, hey, all you guy scholars have a specific view about things which excludes a lot of data. And it's because you're biased, because you're sexist, because you're all guys. There are no women who are in the scholarly establishment, so there's a certain perspective that's being lost. And in fact, a lot of scholarship really changed as more and more women entered academia and brought certain perspectives to the scholarly world. And religion is definitely one of those areas that underwent a lot of change through feminist scholarship. My point, though, is not about feminism, although that's important. My point is about what is it that's going on in scholars' minds that would say, hey, we want to find the original Buddhism or the original Christianity, because that's where the truth is. All this other stuff is less true in some way. What's going on in their mind is what I would refer to as the Edenic myth, which is to say the story of Eden is going on in their minds. Everything was wonderful in the past, and then something happened and everything's been degenerating over time. So in the past, it was true, and that true disposition, or dispensation rather, which came from God through man, or came through the enlightened mind through the Buddha, that somehow was carried forward by the students of the students of the students of the students of the students, and they didn't get it so right anymore. And it kind of degenerated over time. So when you're looking for an original Buddhism, that's what you're looking for. Well, what we've been reading about is the idea that things develop over time. This is what Whitman has been talking about and Jung have been talking about. Things develop over time because human beings and cultures develop over time. And so what human beings and cultures need at one point in time to be happier, say, or have more of a realistic sense of what's going on around them is different than what they needed at another time. For example, the Buddha was clearly a very intelligent person. Nobody's going to argue about that. But he was illiterate. And we'd say, holy cow, the Buddha was illiterate. What was wrong with him? Well, there wasn't any writing when the Buddha was around. That's why the Buddha was illiterate. Okay, so now I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to ask you a question about time. Consider this a thought experiment. Close your eyes. And I want you to think about where is the past in relationship to your body and where is the future in relationship to your body. And I'm going to be much more specific. Is the past on your left side or on your right side? Everybody who thinks the past is on their left side, raise their left hand. Everybody who thinks the past is on their right side, raise your right hand. One person. Are you left-handed or right-handed?
Left-handed.
Left-handed. Okay. So the flow of time, you can open your eyes now. So the flow of time is partly dependent upon whether you're left-handed or right-handed. It's as much as anything, and even more so, dependent upon whether you're right from left to right or right to left. Because if half the class was Muslim, they'd say the past was on the right, because Arabic is written from right to left. So you start on the right and you work to the left when you're writing. Chinese, which used to be written from top to bottom, you ask a Chinese and they say, oh, past is up there and the future's down there. Yeah.
What about forward and back?
What do you mean by forward and back? In front of the body and behind?
Past and future. I thought future.
I know.
Forward, past, future.
Yeah, that's an alternative. But that's at a different level of concept, so I kind of fudged. You're absolutely right. Yeah, that's the way I would tend to view it. If I wasn't thinking left or right, I would tend to think of the future's there and the past is back there because we walk this way and our eyes are like this. Well, there's some interesting experiments. There are interesting experiments about these things. But the main point that I'm wanting to make here is that what we think of as set is actually dependent upon a lot of other factors that are somewhat artificial, like do we write from left to right or right to left? And that will mean something about how we imagine time. So now, what about people who are illiterate? They don't write from left to right. So what if you ask them about past and future, how would they answer? They'd probably answer the way that you answered, which is the past is behind me, the future is ahead of me. Because they do walk, right? And they do have eyes in the front of their heads. So that would perhaps be the more likely response.
Why wouldn't the past be within?
That's another possibility. Outside. And if you ask the Buddha, maybe that's what the Buddha would say. I don't know. But that's another possibility. And that's still set in space. We haven't left space, have we? Which is interesting because time and space aren't really the same thing exactly, are they? Right. There is that. This is all aside because my main point is not about is the past to the left or the right or whatnot. My main right. But my main point is that merely having writing would shape the way you think about something as important as time. So the Buddha lived in a world where there's no writing. Okay? So that means he thought differently about things because he wasn't literate. The Greeks had a lot to say about writing. Most of them didn't have very good things to say about writing when writing was really developed. They would say things like, well, it's going to ruin memory. It did. And on and on. Okay. The point is, the religion of people who are not literate and the religion of people who are literate are obviously different. Now, if your point of view is the religion of people who are not literate is better or worse, you're looking at a problem. The main thing is that religion that exists for people who are not literate solves a different set of problems than religion that exists for people who are literate because they have different problems to deal with. The Buddha said, what I'm about is teaching you how to be rid of suffering. So, if the Buddha is teaching non-literate people how to be rid of suffering, they're going to approach the problem, he's going to approach the problem of suffering for them in a different way because they have a different kind of mind. Because the literate mind is different than the non-literate mind. It just thinks differently, without going into more detail than the simplistic example I gave you, okay? So if you're looking at original Buddhism, because you think that original Buddhism is somehow more true than anything else, you're assuming something, and you're assuming that religion doesn't change in time, which is positive. You're assuming that the changes of a religion over time are not positive. That's the Edenic myth at work. That was my whole point in all of this. Did this make sense now? We kind of zoomed around in circles over this issue. So Forrest? Is there a problem with this?
It's the writing analogy was seemed correct, but it seemed limited in the fact that there's a million other factors
sure.
that are maybe not equal to that, but
okay.
are okay.
No, and what you're saying is makes sense. I just use the writing analogy to illustrate the point. It's not the end all and be all. It's just to sort of get your mind wrapped around the idea that at different times people think differently and have different kinds of needs. If religion is designed or serves the function of meeting human needs, then as human needs are different over time, then religion needs to be different to meet those needs. And the idea that original Buddhism or original Christianity is the only thing that can meet our needs, therefore, is problematic because we have different needs than the people of the time of the Buddha. And that was all I was really trying to illustrate by this. So the contrary idea, again, to come back to this, is human beings grow and develop from the point of view of being children to adults, human beings grow and develop over the millennia, we call that evolution. Cultures grow and develop over the millennia. We maybe don't want to call it evolution. Maybe we just want to call it the development of culture. So religions also develop over time. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It could be a good thing. So to assume it's one thing or the other can be very problematic. So the people we're reading don't even assume it's good, bad, or indifferent. They just say it is what it is. That's the way it is. Everything develops and changes over time. So we need to take that into account if we're trying to understand what is religion and what does it do. That took a long time to get to that point. Okay. So now let's go back to the basic Buddhist stuff that we've been looking at. So the basic idea that originates with the Buddha is this idea about the five aggregates. We know it goes back to the time of the Buddha. It's one of his core teachings. And the Buddha was not interested in metaphysical ideas. He refused to discuss what we would call metaphysical ideas with the people who came to him. He said, that doesn't really matter. Who created the world, when it was created, how it was created, why it was created, was it created? All that stuff is irrelevant. Why are you here with me now? You're here with me now because there's something about your life, the way you exist, which is a problem for you, and you want to do something about it. Now, those problems could be multiple. People came to him with different kinds of problems. Ladies would come to him and say, my mother-in-law is driving me crazy. My husband beats me. I don't want to have any more children, but my husband insists on sex, and I can't escape it. But I just can't stand to have any more children. On and on and on and on. All kinds of human problems. He would deal with those problems. But if somebody came to him and said, it's driving me crazy, I just can't figure out where the world came from, he'd say, nah, I don't think that's what's driving you crazy. Something else is driving you crazy. Let's look at what's really driving you crazy. Okay. What he came to over and over again was he'd ask people to examine their own experience. He'd say, I don't have some revealed doctrine. God didn't talk to me, and then I'm telling you what God had to say. Some of the Brahmin priests would say that sort of thing. He didn't say, I went to heaven in a vision, and I was told this truth about things, which you could read in the Upanishads. And some very interesting stuff there. I don't mean to demean this. But the Buddha was very practical, and he said, let's look at your experience and start with your experience and see where that takes us. So the five skandhas, that's the Sanskrit word for the five aggregates. I'm sorry, I keep slipping back and forth because I'm very familiar with that language. The five aggregates were the way he talked about that. And he started off by saying, look, one thing we can all agree on is that you have a mind and a body. Anybody argue about that? Nobody would argue about that. So he said, you've got a body. Technically, they call that form or matter in their language. And you have a mind. But more specifically, you have consciousness. That's really what he meant. So you have consciousness and you have a body, don't you? And everyone could say, yeah, okay, we can start with that point. We may not know how they relate to each other if they were more sophisticated, but they'd say, yeah, we agree with them. Okay. So let's look at what's going on here. And he said, one thing is that all of your experience is actually perception. When you say, I have an experience of something like this table here, right? You take it for granted that this table is physically right here. But if you think about the nature of your experience, you realize that when you look at it, what's happening is there is something going on outside in the world of matter. Like we know that light rays are bouncing off the table. That's what's happening in the world of matter. I am aware of the table, so that's there. But there's something else going on, which is I have a sense organ. And the thing that's really interesting about eyes, which is different than all your other senses, is you can close your eyes and sight goes away. If you couldn't close your eyes so that sight went away when you closed your eyes, it would be very hard for you to deduce the fact that perception requires a sense organ. So you can't make the sound in your ears go away. So sound is something that just seems to exist. You have to deduce that your ears are somehow involved in sound. If you put your hand over your ear, the sounds change, so you know your ears are somehow involved in sound. But the ability to close your eyes makes it very, very clear that vision is a sensory experience. And as the Buddha would say, it requires the coming together of sense objects, the physical world, a sense organ, your eyeball, and awareness. If any one of those three things is missing, you don't see anything, right? Okay. That goes for all the senses. So that was the first thing that he then laid down as somewhat more abstract, because that's the idea of perception. It's not literally the case that in my experience, I'm having an experience of this table. What I'm actually having is a perception, which I construct as a table, because there's the object, there's the sense organ, and there is my awareness. And from that, I perceive the image of table. Same for all the other sense organs. Then the other thing he invited, so he said, and if we look at this, we see that these are the parts to this. So now, then he invited people to observe something else. In regards to every perception, they had a reaction. And that reaction was they either liked the perception, they didn't like it, or they didn't care about it one way or the other. And if they liked the perception, they were attracted to it. If they didn't like it, they ran away from it. They wanted to get away from it. And if they were neutral about it, it didn't make any difference to them. An example would be gold. You're walking down the road and there's a gold coin. I mean, we're in the ancient world, so it's a gold coin, okay? Or better yet, a gold bracelet, even more likely. There's a gold bracelet on the road. Gold, that's valuable. You're attracted to it, okay? It's possible you could be repelled by it. Now, it's hard for us to imagine. Maybe it's a dog turd instead of a golden bracelet. So you're repelled, okay? Or maybe it's just a stick, and you notice it, and you don't care about it one way or the other. But the Buddha said, is there a fourth option? Now, some people would say that the neutral response is a combination of attraction and repulsion. So that was open to a bit of debate. Is there anything that's really neutral? Are you really neutral about anything? Maybe what we call neutrality is kind of an even mix of attracted, repulsed. Anyhow, so there's this ambiguity about that particular thing. But there's nothing outside of that. There's no alternative to those. He said that, and those things are very different than anything else. Being attracted to something is not like a perception. It's not like you're seeing something. Attraction is not a form. It's not an awareness. It's something else. Something's going on inside of you. He said, that's a very unique category of things. So he said, that we got form or body, matter. We got consciousness. We have perceptions. And we have feelings. That was the language that they used for being attracted to things or repelled by things. Those are feelings, not sentiment, but feelings. He said, then there's a whole lot of other stuff which doesn't fit into any of those categories that has to do really with the way our mind functions. Memory, habits is a good one. Think about a habit. What is a habit or a predisposition? You get up in the morning, you get out of bed, you put on your pajamas if you don't sleep in pajamas, or if you do sleep in pajamas, you look for your slippers. And you put your slippers on. You don't put both of them on at the same time, probably, if you're standing up. If you're sitting down, you might. But if you're standing up, you put one slipper on, then you put the other slipper on. I'll bet you anything that you always put either the right slipper on before the left or the left before the right, that you don't alternate, unless you're very unusual. Okay. You're unusual. All right. Most people have a habit of doing one thing and then the other thing. Habit is very interesting. Where is a habit? Habits are not physical. They're not exactly consciousness. They're not perception. They have nothing to do with attraction or repulsion. They're just out there somehow, but they're really controlling. Habits control us. Ask a junkie about whether or not habits control us. Ask somebody who smokes cigarettes about whether or not habits control us. They do. So there's all this other category of internal mental type stuff. He said, now, apart from all of those things, what else is there? Is there anything else? Well, generally, people said, there is one other thing. And he would say, okay, what is that? He said, me. Hey, you forgot me in this analysis. Where is me? And the Buddha would say, okay, well, let's look for you. Let's see if we can find you. And then he would invite students to do that. His students, when I say students. So I'll invite you to do that. So this is a kind of a traditional way of thinking about this question. So, first question is, when you're looking for me, you find me. You have no trouble. I'm sitting here. I am sitting here listening to this professor talk. Okay. We all can agree on that. Anybody disagree with that? Okay. No disagreements. Now, are you your body? That's the first question. Who thinks that they are, their body? Okay. We got one person thinks they're the body. Okay. If you are your body, are you the same or different if you lose an arm? Are you the same or different if you lose an arm?
Different.
You're different. Okay. Got a picture of yourself when you were a little kid?
I look the same.
No.
Well,
I pretty much look the same. I just got a little bigger. My face really didn't change.
Your body is really different than when you were prepubescent. There's no question about that.
Shorter.
There are lots of parts of your body that are different. We don't have to go into detail. You know, we know that that's the case. Okay. The point is that are you the same person now as you were then? Do you really feel the same? You don't feel the same. So much for this thought experiment. Now I'm in trouble. So you feel like you were two different people then and now. So then the question is, are you a consistent entity or not? Okay. Now, when you examine your sense of I right now, do you feel like you're unchanging or that you're changing?
I think I'm pretty changing.
You think you're pretty changing? So now you're different people. You're not just one people.
There's different ways I can act, I guess is what I think.
So when you're being a mom, do you feel like the same person as when you're sitting here in the classroom?
That I don't know.
Okay. All right. The point of this analysis, at least the way the Buddhists did it, maybe David didn't do it so well. The point of this analysis, the way the Buddhists did it, was to discover that in your own sentiment, your own sense of things, I, the subject, and the body are recognized as not being the same, as being related to each other, but not identical. That to say I am my body somehow doesn't work because I don't feel like my body is an adequate way of defining me. That my body is part of me in a certain way, but I am more than my body. That's not an adequate way of articulating what constitutes me. So we don't have a whole lot of time left, but I'll kind of foreshorten the analysis. You can do it on your own later if you want to. You can go through all of the five aggregates, and the same thing happens. Am I my habits? Well, you know, my habits tend to define me a lot, but do they define me totally? No, for one reason. We've just gotten through saying that to a great extent my body is me, and my habits are other than my body. So am I my body or am I my habits? Well, you know, I and body and habits, they're somehow intermixed with each other, but they're not all the same, they're not all different, and they're not all totally inclusive. Because a whole lot of people would say, you know, really the essence of what's me is my sense of awareness. That I'm kind of an internal subject, an internal actor who's acting through my body. A lot of people feel like they live inside of their bodies, that they are not literally their body, but they somehow are inside their body. I mean, I feel that way. I don't feel like my fingertips are I, or that my foot is I. I feel, my native way of feeling about this is like I'm sort of like in a little space suit on the inside of my chest someplace, kind of, you know, pulling strings and making things work. Technical term for that is homunculus. There's even a word for it.
The wizard behind the
Yeah, the wizard behind the wizard behind the curtain. Very good. The wizard behind the curtain. Yeah. A lot of people feel that way. I don't think everybody feels that way. If you talk to a dancer, dancers are more likely to feel like they are the whole body. Right? They're not like a little thing inside manipulating a body. On the other hand, if you talk to mathematicians, like talk to Stephen Hawking, I don't think Stephen Hawking is going to tell you he's that crumpled up body in a wheelchair. I think he'd tell you that the eye in him feels like something else. Right? So that's kind of a typical thing. The point of all the analysis is, since we are running short of time, the point of all the analysis is where the Buddhists ended up with this, where the Buddha ended up with this when he was asking this question of his students was, you can't find the sense of I in one of these categories alone. Now, he would get to the point where everybody understood there's nothing outside of those five categories, that they are inclusive of everything. So then if you go through each of the five categories, you can't find I in any one of them. Nor can you find I in just a couple of them. But if you look at all of them, then you could say, yeah, I can see that the I is somehow related to all of them. So is it the same as them, or is it different than them? All right. So, I mean, you can think about this stuff on your own if you want to. And what people would come to as a conclusion, typically, would be, well, you can't say that I is the same as the five aggregates, but you can't really say that I is different than the five aggregates. You can't say it's in any one, but you can't really say that it's not somehow related to that. Nobody would say that I doesn't include the body in some way. Nobody would say that I doesn't include consciousness in some way, because nobody experiences I when they're in dreamless sleep. Everyone's aware of the fact that they don't experience I in dreamless sleep. So somehow I and consciousness have some kind of complex relationship with each other. What the conclusion that the Buddha came to about this is that I, the sense of I, which we feel so strongly, is something which naturally arises when all these elements are there together, called the aggregates. And it naturally arises under those circumstances. But it doesn't have an existence outside of naturally arising under those circumstances. Now, of course, from a religious point of view, this is an important conclusion, because a lot of people say, I've got a soul, whatever that is, and when I die, something's going to happen to my soul. So now the Buddha is saying, well, now wait a minute. What are we talking about here? If you say that I am my soul, most people would say the sense of I is my soul. That's pretty common. But I is somehow, it exists in dependence on the five aggregates, but it can't exist without the five aggregates. It arises naturally through the five aggregates. So then the logical question is, what happens when you die? What happens to that sense of I when you die? Because when you die, these things cease to function. The body ceases to function, right? Consciousness goes away. Apparently, when you die, consciousness goes away. No perception. Dead people aren't aware of anything, as far as we know. Maybe they are. Anyhow, no one's aware of it. Ghosts don't have bodies. Maybe they could tell you that they were aware of something, but they don't have bodies, right? Things change. So the Buddhist argument is that we can't know anything about this so-called soul, because it's nothing that seems very rational to us, because we can't find it. It's just an idea that you have about things. At least in regards to I, you experience it, and you can understand it as something that seems to arise out of this concatenation of parts, but you don't really know anything more about it. And the other thing that's recognizable out of this analysis is that whatever seems to be the I, which exists when all these parts hang together, is not permanent, that it changes. Because although you may feel like the same I now as when you were a child, so Cheryl says, I feel like the same I now as when I was a child, but the body is different. And actually, if you could get in a time machine and somehow zoom back into the body of a child and experience what was going on, I'm pretty sure you'd find that you're not having the same kind of experience. I know that when I was your age, or anyhow, when I was, say, 19 or 20, I'm not sure how old you are, when I was 19 or 20, I know that a very strong experience I had over and over again was feeling like things were not as bright and lively as they had been when I was 7 or 8. When I was 19, 18, 20, I could remember the experiences that I had when I was a child of 7, 8, 9, 10. I can't remember those things anymore, but at the time I could. And but what I do remember is feeling at the time that somehow, in growing older, I had lost the clarity, vitality, immediacy, and joy that I experienced as a child. That my experience as a child was radically different than it was when I was a college student. A lot of interesting things happened to me in college. I'm not saying that they didn't. But the immediacy of my experience and the character of my experience, I knew was different. Anymore, I can only remember that I had that experience of knowing it was different, but I can't remember what the differences were in terms of a tangible kind of something. It's been too long. Okay. So the Buddhist point in all of this is it's not truly the case that anything stays the same. Even your experience of yourself, your experience of the world around you, is really changing over time. The only thing that stays the same over that period of time is you think that everything about the experience, and in particular yourself, has stayed the same over that period of time. You firmly, absolutely, deeply believe that I, me, the self, has been consistent over that period of time and fundamentally hasn't changed. All experience to the contrary. Now, I'm sure that there are some people who don't believe that, which means that they have an elevated state of awareness. But that's the most common experience. So you may not experience that, but that would make you unusual. Most people do experience things that way. And if you really were to perform this analysis with most people, this is where you would end up. Okay? I mean, the Buddha did it very skillfully, unlike the way that I'm doing it, and that's where they ended up. Technically, the way the Buddhists phrased this was the sense of I is designated on the group of aggregates. We might say that it arises in relationship to them naturally, or that it's an emergent property, if you like, systems theory. They didn't have that concept back there. They had the idea that it's mentally a concept. I is mentally a concept designated on the concatenation of all the aggregates, and that it has a reality. Now, this is the key point. It has a reality, but it doesn't have the reality it appears to have. That's where we'll pick up the next time we meet. I has a reality, but not the reality it appears to have. And this is important in the history and the evolution of religions. So we'll leave it at that point. Okay?